The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
The Nicole Sandler Show. Questioning authority daily. And that could be the very reason why YouTube is upset. Hey, YouTube. The music bed you hear beneath my voice is from a broadcast sound library that I pay for and have the receipts. So I've got your copyright violation right here. And now, here's Nicole.
And just like that, welcome to a Friday. I'm so proud of us because, yeah, we have made it to the end of another week. Most of us, anyway. And we are, you know, and this week was very similar to the week before, which was very similar to the week before, except when we see the numbers going up. And we see the madman at his, you know, two-hour commandeered infomercials, I don't know, trying to rush things along while the scientists are saying, hold up, buddy, you know, hold your horses, as my mom used to say. We don't want to rush into anything because you open things up and we get a second wave, it's going to be worse than the first. So who knows what's going on? I think right now what we need to do is take hold of what's in our minds, in our hearts, and our souls, and make sure we're taken care of. One of the casualties in this quarantine, I really believe, is not going to be evident for quite some time. And the casualty I'm talking about is our peace of mind. We all, to varying degrees, struggle with some kind of mental health issues. With me, it's depression, has been for years. With some people, it's anxiety. Some people, you know, everybody's got our own shit. And when we're stuck in a high-stress situation the way we all are, we all deal with it differently. One of the problems among many in our healthcare system is the lack of availability for good psychological help. Now, thankfully, the Affordable Care Act made it so that mental health care was included in every insurance policy. But since Trump opened the door to these junk policies again, you could be paying for insurance without those protections and not and have no coverage. Or you could be like my kid who's, you know, she turns 21 in 3 weeks. Oh, my God. And this year bought her policy on the exchange, which is way too expensive for what she gets. High deductible and copay. And the premium ain't cheap either. And this is a kid, a 20-year-old with no medical problems. But if she wants to go see a therapist, her copay per visit is $65. That's not affordable. And that's just one of the major issues that we are going to need to deal with if and when we come out of this on the other side. All right, I'm going to do things a little different today because we are so jam-packed that I don't have time for a funny. I mean, I guess I could, but it means we'd be hitting Kelly Carlin a little later. Here's what we'll do. Perhaps at the end of the show, we'll do an overtime. If the Progressive Voices listeners won't get it, but the podcast people will, and people listening live will. So we'll save the funny and the what's news for the end of the show today. We'll fit it all in. We'll just run a little bit of overtime. If you listen to Progressive Voices at 5, you'll get the meat of the program. And the meat, as I've been promoting for the week, Kelly Carlin's going to join us at the tail end to do sort of a guided meditation. This is what she does. I mean, she's got, she was raised by her dad, George Carlin. So she got the comedy, the sense of humor, the irreverence, the, you know, the stuff that makes her like one of us. And, but she also studied for years and got her master's in Jungian psychology. And takes it very seriously. And she does coaching sessions and she does seminars via Zoom. We'll talk about all that. But she's going to, I give her a special assignment for today because we're all in this together. So she's going to lead us on a guided meditation that hopefully you can use again and again. It's not just this one-time deal. Thankfully, my show is not behind a paywall. So you can share it. You can get it on YouTube. You can get it on the podcast. However, whatever works for you, whatever floats your boat, go for it. But we're going to start with an interview that I actually recorded a couple hours ago. And we recorded it mostly for logistics sake, because Ali Velshi and others at MSNBC and other news organizations are working pretty screwy hours these days. So he never knows when he's going to be on call. There, you know, everything's all messed up. So we figured we both had a good chunk of time today at around noon. So he hopped on Skype from his home and I hopped on it from my home studio. And we recorded this interview. And the way it came about was just a little, I'm a bitch. I'm such a bitch sometimes on social media. And I called out Ali for something. And I've long been a fan of his. I really do appreciate his work. And I think he's one of a very small handful of people at MSNBC who I truly, truly respect and enjoy watching and listening to. So I felt badly when I sort of had a little tussle with him on Twitter. But he handled it beautifully, and we became buds, and we exchanged emails, and I invited him on the show. And, well, here's how it went. Joining me on the line now is Ali Velshi. He's somebody that, well, we welcome into our homes all the time. I've become a big fan of Ali Velshi's. In fact, I started really following you, Ali, when you joined Al Jazeera America. Because I was excited that for the first time in this era, we had a news channel that was about news. It wasn't about one ideology over another. The goal there was to present news in an objective manner, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was two goals. One is news in the absence of, what we used to think of as news, being as objective as possible. And we can discuss what objectivity is, because I think we've learned over time that maybe it's not exactly what we think it is. But that was one of the goals. And the other goal that I thought was really important is because I'd been a journalist probably 20 some odd years before I joined Al Jazeera. And we were really concentrated on telling stories from the perspective of the voiceless, or being a voice for the voiceless. And it occurred to me, while I had always thought about those things, and I thought I was reporting about those things, my life as a journalist in New York City working for mainstream media doesn't expose me to a whole lot of voiceless people as we go out of our way to find them. Mm-hmm. Even our most junior employees at a media organization are powerful, right? Because they can call up anybody and tell them they're from the media. So I really, it caused me to get outside of a zone in which I had been operating. It wasn't a shift in ideology for me or the way I think about things, but it really caused me to say, how do you tell stories from the perspective of the very people who don't have the voice, whom you talk about, whom you analyze, whom you characterize all the time? And I have to say, Nicole, that was a bigger challenge than a guy like me thought it was going to be. I thought this was obvious, right? I know who these voiceless people are. I know what their challenges are. I know what their lives are. Well, I didn't. Mm-hmm. And it changed my perspective. It was a remarkable experience for me for that reason.
And then, unfortunately, as these things happen, Al Jazeera didn't catch on here. Do you think it was more, because I enjoyed watching them. I like the objectivity. I'm always looking for it because it helps me organize my thoughts so I can be more objective about what I cover. And my show is not objective news coverage. It's opinion and commentary, but always based in fact. That's got to be the underlying basis. Otherwise, it's worthless. So I was bummed when it went away. And I wonder how much of it was xenophobia, was the fact that Al Jazeera was an Arabic network that was based in Qatar. And it was that a big part of it?
So, you know, the other day somebody tweeted me something that was meant to be criticism and said, you know, how'd that Al Jazeera thing work out for you? And I said, did you watch it? And they said, no, I never did. It was biased. And I said, so you never watched anything on Al Jazeera America? And he said, no. And I said, would you mind looking some stuff up for me and letting me know what you thought was biased about that? And so that was the problem. Those people who watched, even if they had political biases, we had people watching us who were conservative, who were liberal, but they felt that they could get the news. And those people who never did think so. And part of that was that logo, which was remarkable Arabic calligraphy. It was a competition that somebody won many years ago design the Al Jazeera logo, which to the untrained eye, including mine, looks a whole lot like ISIS's logo, frankly. Mm-hmm. I mean, we are not familiar with Arabic. We're certainly not familiar with Arabic calligraphy. Nope. And we're not familiar with Arabic anything, right? In North American society, there is no car, there is no chewing gum, there is no soft drink. Arabic to Americans for the last 25 years has generally speaking been associated with bad things, terrorism, Al-Qaeda, stuff yep. like that. And that was very difficult to overcome. So I think that was a lot of it. So I don't think it's that people watched it and objected to it. I think the people who watched it actually came around to the idea that it was pretty good. There were some people who would just never watch it.
Exactly.
There were some carriers that would never carry it.
Yeah, it's that. It's the inbred bigotry. It's that institutional racism. Now, you, Ali Velshi, have made no secret of your background. You're a Kenyan-born Muslim who then grew up in Canada, is now living and working here in the States. And I'm guessing that you've gotten both, kudos for that and some criticism, because people are like that.
It comes up every few weeks. Somebody will tweet it, as if it's a criticism. It's like it's in my Twitter bio.
Right.
I was actually just annoyed because for a long time I was the most famous Kenyan-born Muslim I knew until Barack Obama showed up on the scene.
Damn
so,
him.
You know, I say it tongue in cheek to right. say I'm actually that guy, and he was never at any of the meetings.
Exactly.
So, to me, I did grow up in a world in which varied experience and diversity is of value. And that can be from anywhere. That could be socioeconomic, it could be where you are, where you're from, what you speak, what color you are, what gender you are, what you identify with. So I've never, ever, ever thought of that as a negative, right? To me, it's like, list the stuff you are
yeah.
and let people make with it, make what they will of it. Today, the concept of being foreign, immigrant, Muslim, global in perspective, Canada, some people associate with socialist. It's fascinating the buckets people will quickly put you into. I'm not actually that complex of being. I just sort of put it out there to say, hey, this is if you wonder where my thinking comes from, if you wonder why I support single payer, health care. It's not actually a Bernie Sanders thing to
mm-hmm.
me. It's the right. system in which I grew up. It's a system that I've studied, and it seems to work. That it happened to align for a few minutes with Bernie Sanders' campaign is interesting, but that's not where it came from with me. So I put it out there to say, whatever you think I think, because I'm a Kenyan-born Muslim who grew up in Canada, you're probably right.
Or not, because you're a human being, and you're here, and for me, first and foremost, as a viewer and a power consumer of news media, you're one of the best. Now, I know we met virtually through Twitter some time ago when one morning I was in a pissy mood and I probably hadn't had enough coffee. And you said, I'm a big Bernie Sanders supporter for some of the reasons you already mentioned, the single payer and just his consistency over the years. And one morning, and it was like maybe only your second week in the new slot in the new Velshi show, which is now on Saturdays and Sundays from 8 to 10 Eastern morning. I'm, one of those old people who doesn't sleep and wakes up early in the morning, so I see it all the time. Anyway, I called you out in a pissy moment, and you were so wonderful in the way you responded to me, and you really engaged with me. Some of your colleagues have blocked me over the years, and rightly so, probably. I blocked some of them, but I was so thrilled to have this conversation with you, and it verified my belief in that you're a good guy, you're a decent human being, and you're smart. And that's one of the reasons I enjoy watching you, because you do give a very well-rounded view of the whatever story you're talking about. You give background, and you do it without much personal commentary invoked, although not that there's anything wrong with that. I do it on a daily basis, but you give us the facts, and especially at a time like this, that is so important. And that's one of the things I wanted to talk to you about today, is how life reporting on the news has changed when we're living the biggest news story any of us has ever even imagined. The idea of a pandemic was always out there, and obviously the administration had been briefed on it too, not that they took it seriously, but we as a people, as a planet, have never lived through anything like this. How has it changed your world, other than obviously in the mechanics we see in the coverage and you're working from home? In a bigger picture, how has it changed you?
Well, on a few levels, first of all, for your comment, I don't really recall our fight. I recall the resolution. I recall the fact that we decided to engage and have a conversation. To me, that's the good part, right? I'm fine with criticism. We should often have it. And by the way, I think I was one of Bernie Sanders' last interviews before he stepped out of the race.
And I have to thank you for that too, by the way, because that did not go unnoticed, and it was a great interview too. So thank you for that.
We had a great interview, and I've always enjoyed a great relationship with the senator editorially, and I like that. So a lot of things have changed. I've covered a lot of the very big stories of our time. Right? I've covered the I covered 9/11. I covered the recession. I covered various, you know, I've covered hurricanes and earthquakes and wars. This is so different. Never mind the mechanics, which is fascinating, right? I'm broadcasting from my home right now. Actually, one of my colleagues, a photographer, is here adjusting some lighting and fixing some things. But the mechanics aside of anchoring a show, there's that. Then there's the actual news gathering, right? The idea that we have to tell real people stories. And that means going into places where real people are. And that this is a time when that's just weird, right? People don't necessarily want you coming into their homes. We're not out there all the time. So this, Skype, Zoom, things like that have become much more valuable. But remember that we as a network operate on the basis that we have contacts who have our companies, who have communications experts. That regular folks don't have that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So social media, Twitter, the stories about people's lives have become crucial and important. Frontline workers, right? I get outside in Manhattan at 7 p.m. every day and clap for those people out there, the frontline workers, including the grocery delivery people, the doormen, the nurses. But I don't talk to them. I don't interview them. So we've had to find ways to do that. And we do that. We are talking to home health care aides and grocery store workers and people like that to tell us how what impact this has on them. And I think that's a part of our the new way we think about things that is going to be good. Right. Maybe we can tell a lot more stories from the bottom up than we can from the perspective of presidents and princes and prime ministers down. So that's one very good part about this. But the other thing about it that's fascinating is in the big stories that I've covered, even in 9/11, we thought it was existential. We thought it was going to be a massive threat to our way of life. And ultimately it was, and it wasn't going to destroy us. And in the recession, we thought about all the ways in which it was going to damage our lives and our prosperity, but we weren't scared of the people around us. Mm-hmm. This is so new. You don't know where this threat lies. So your brain can't get your head around who fixes this. How does it get fixed? This is science. This is leadership. This is government. And we don't know how to process that. So we're doing it in real time. And you'll notice every single week on TV, our behavior changes a little bit because the story has shifted. Is it about fear? Is it about numbers? Is it about leadership? Is it about the economy? Is it about failures in government? Is it about medical science? So it's such a fast evolving story about things around which we don't have a pre-established expertise.
Right. And what I'm noticing also is we're all being affected by this in ways that we probably won't even know for months and maybe in some cases years to come. And I'm talking about mental health. And I'm somebody, I've been open about this on my show. I have always struggled with depression my entire adult life since adolescence. And I had a really, really rough time after Donald Trump's election, where I had I can look back now and describe it as a breakdown. Right. I did my job. I did a show every day. Don't ask me how I got through it. I'm afraid if I were to go back and listen to some of those shows, I'd be mortified because I got to the point where I'd had to write out every word. I was a nervous wreck. I questioned everything. And this is something I've been doing for 40 years. I've been in radio and I would shake before I opened the mic. It so thoroughly destroyed me. And I somehow got through it, came out on the other side, maybe seeing, all right, we're coming closer to an election time and maybe we can get rid of this man. But it has really affected me. And now, you know, just when we thought things couldn't get any worse, really, as a nation, as a planet, we're not going to go any lower, we get hit by this pandemic. And so many of us are just, I'm a lung cancer survivor and I'm 60 years old. I can't go out there. So it's changed every aspect of our lives. And it's changed the way I do my show because no longer do I want to dig down deep on all the numbers and the news and the it's too much. I want
that's what we know.
Right. So I'm hitting on a more human level. I think I mentioned this to you in an email. I happened upon a Facebook group called Room View from My Room that now in a short month has over 1 million members who people at every corner of the planet, they take pictures of the view from their house, say where they are. They're everywhere from Zimbabwe to South Africa to Australia, New Zealand, and Bolivia and Brazil and all over the States. And I'm looking at these and I start reaching out to some of these people and connecting with them. And I've invited them on the show. So I'm doing this new segment called Quarantine Calling, where I connected yesterday with a wonderful woman from Finland. Somebody else in Denmark, somebody in Italy, and it just, it's a small world and we're all on this in a unique moment in history when we're all experiencing basically the same thing. And I'm having a hard time verbalizing what that is, but just trying to connect with people. Those kind of stories are what somehow make me feel a little better, and it gives me a way to pass things along to listeners. Are you more interested in stuff like that? Because we also need you to help explain about the PPP program running out of money and why some of us haven't gotten our $1,200 yet.
Yeah. And that is what we still do and what we still should do. But I have had segments on my shows that I have not had on my shows in 25 years or 30 years of doing this. I had an expert on grief the other day, talking about the collective grief we all feel, not just the grief of those of us who have lost somebody to COVID, but the loss, the feeling that we feel about the loss of normalcy in our lives actually feels like grief. And then there are those people who have lost somebody during this period, not to coronavirus, but they can't have a funeral or they can't be with them or they can't have a memorial service. I talked to somebody the other day about what young LGBTQ people go through, right? Because let's say you've had to leave school or leave your work and quarantine in place with your family, which wasn't safe space for you to start with.
Yeah.
I had someone talking about people who are abused in their relationships. Where do you go when
those
you
got
to actually be with someone and you can't run to the shelter and you don't have places that are open to you? So, you know, we would give them tips as to what to do. What do you do if you suffer from anxiety? Or first of all, we're all sufferers of anxiety now. Those of us who didn't appreciate what anxiety was when people, you know, when you said, well, that's not really rational. What's your fear of that?
Of
is it's
not.
Like, guess what? We're all irrationally fearful all the time. Thank you for talking openly about your depression, because for people who are suffering from these things, this becomes that much more complicated. You don't have the same access to either therapists or medication or doctors that you typically have. And when everybody else is anxious, how do you share those concerns with people? And I feel like that is immediate and in the center of this conversation and necessary. We started running an ad on MSNBC probably 3 weeks ago. You know, we have the series that's called This Is Who We Are.
Uh-huh. Right.
And we changed it to We Are In This Together.
Uh-huh.
And it was just imagery of around the world and in America, the things people do to help other people in these times and to cope. I've invited people. I have a email address, mystory@velshi.com, to just tell me, how are you coping? Good, bad, send me videos, send me pictures. And we tell that story every show. I do an obituary every show. Just to remember that these are real people's lives that were lived. And my producer, Emma, writes it and she sends it to me and I read it. And I always smile because the stories are so good. And then I always cry when I deliver them on TV. I've read it already. I know what it's going to say. And yet I can't keep it together. So these are ways in which we have changed. But I do agree with you. We have learned to find strength in each other. And that doesn't mean that you and I shouldn't argue on Twitter or we shouldn't have political arguments. I think we should. Somebody said to me last night, I did a webinar, and they said, do you think we can put aside our political bickering as we lead into the election to deal with this? And I said, no.
Yeah.
I said, people died for our right to politically bicker. You may call it bickering, and sometimes it feels like bickering, and sometimes it feels small and petty. But it is actually central to who we are. So for all we hate about coronavirus and being stuck in our homes, think about those people in the world who don't also have an election coming up in which they can vote, who don't have freedoms, who live in a refugee camp, who have no money at all, who live in abject poverty and can't do the things that we can do to social distance and keep clean all the time. We have democracy and we have a vote. And it's this is not the time to shy away from our adulthood and our democratic rights and our constitutional obligations for free speech. So bicker and fix coronavirus at the same time. We can actually walk and chew gum at the same time.
Most definitely. The only but then there's the other aspect that we've steered clear of so far, but it's the 239-pound and then some elephant in the room by way of Donald Trump, who if you knew that we were going to be struck with a global pandemic of these proportions, this scary, who is the last person you'd want in the White House? Donald Trump. And yet he goes up there, he commandeers two and a half hours of prime television time every night. I know MSNBC has gotten a little better at pulling away from him and trying to fact check him in real time. But to have him spout some of the crap he's spouting off is just so irresponsible and frightening. And it's, you know, my husband, I watch it because I say I have to. It's my job. I need to know what he's saying. And my husband can't be in the room. It's making him nuts. This is another aspect. I watch the way he berates journalists just doing their job. And if you're not complimentary of him, if you don't couch your question with praise, he'll call you the worst names that no adult should ever call anybody, let alone the president of the United States. I wonder on a daily basis, why don't these people get up and walk out? And then I answer my question and I say, because then all that would be left covering him is Fox and OANN. And that's as much of a disservice as covering this stuff.
The two things I always think journalists have to do, one is to bear witness, right? To tell people something is happening. And you think about the Yazidis on Mount Sinjar, or you think about Darfur, or you think about the Rohingya. If there weren't somebody to tell you it was happening, we actually wouldn't know because we'd all be on our feeds, which we have curated for ourselves, and the story wouldn't get there. So part of the reason we have to be in that room is to bear witness. Even if it's incredibly hard to watch. This is the president of the United States that was elected by American people, and the consequence of having that president is having that president, and we have to tell you that. But the other really important thing that you're getting at is the other responsibility that journalists have is to speak truth to power, mm-hmm. to hold power to account. And there are some journalists in that room who on a daily basis, and by the way, it's not like anchoring a show where you've booked your guests, you know who they are, you've done research, you had a booker look into them, you've got a segment producer, you've read their articles. You have no idea on a daily basis what Donald Trump is going to do.
Nope.
And his mind works very differently than mine does. So I give a little extra credence to those reporters in that room because he says stuff and then you have to decide, am I holding him to account for the thing that I thought I was holding him account for? Did he just say something really weird that I need to challenge, or do I need to get information on what they know? So it's hard. And there are some reporters, my friend Yamiche Alcindor PBS, one of them, who, you know, he picks on her all the time. He belittles her all the time. He's got some bee in his bonnet about her, and she holds her patience and continues to ask her questions. And the other day when he skipped past her because he didn't want to give her another question, a couple reporters later, Jeremy Diamond from CNN, took his opportunity and gave her the mic back.
Yeah.
So there are some moments of glory in these things. But somebody said something to me before coronavirus when I was anchoring on Friday nights. I anchor Lawrence O'Donnell's show.
Right.
Last Word. And she came on and she said, This is for grownups. This is not a time when you can say this person's going to come in and save me. Mm-hmm. That's now not going to happen. So you are going to do the things you have to do, the most powerful of which remains your vote, others of which remain keeping your family safe, keeping yourself safe, social distancing where necessary, finding those around you who need resources, who you can help either figure out how to get their $1,200 or figure out how to file for unemployment, or if they don't file for unemployment, what can you do to help those around you? I have seen acts of kindness that I didn't know possible. in the last couple of months. Just people saying, do you need money? Mm-hmm. Tweet me, need money. What you just said about talking to people, random people around the world. People saying, call me if you need someone to talk to. We're going to fix ourselves. We're going to take the mantle of leadership. And I will say one thing. When Joe Biden launched his campaign, he talked about recapturing the soul of America, and he talked about Charlottesville and how far we've come. You know, he's changed his whole theme now, and he's talking about who he's going to pick for his cabinet.
Yeah.
And if you think back to 2008, during the election, during the financial crisis, John McCain had been doing pretty well, and then he picked Sarah Palin as his running mate. And Barack Obama lined up with all of Clinton's senior economic advisors behind him. Basically, this is going to be the team that's going to help me out. And Joe Biden switched strategy to say, look, maybe you've got doubts about who I am or what my actual capabilities are, but I'm going to start to line up a team for you so you know who is going to lead you out of that. Interesting theory, given that America right now is so hungry for leadership. So that I think we're all pivoting and we're all making adjustments to say, you can watch that White House press briefing every day. Your solution and your leadership's not going to come from there. So find it where you can and find it in yourself if you can.
Right. Well, hopefully. I mean, then there are those of us waiting on the edges saying, OK, who Joe Biden assembles is of the utmost importance. If he goes back to the old well and brings in Larry Summers and Tim Geithner and the same old Clinton Obama crew, that's not going to do the trick. He needs to. I've already said I've got my my industrial strength nose clips from my lung cancer battle that I used for pulmonary testing. I used this in 2016 to vote for Hillary Clinton, and I'm planning to use it again to vote for Joe Biden. But I want to know that he's talking with the Sanders camp and the Warren camp, and that they're going to take our wants and considerations into effect. I would love to see Joe Biden right now announce his running mate because, he's no spring chicken. That person could likely be president. So that's an important consideration. And I want to know who else he's going to surround himself with. And I just hope that I wish he would use this time to bring in people and say, these are the people I'm looking at. Do you think, all the rules are thrown out. Everything is going to have to change now. Is that a possibility?
Yeah, I wonder. The running mate question is a big one, and I don't know whether he'll move quickly on that. But I think the way around that, if he weren't going to move quickly around this, is to sort of say this is what the cabinet looks like. Now, that's going to be weird, because if all of a sudden there isn't a Kamala Harris or there isn't an Elizabeth Warren or there isn't somebody like that, does that just put the running mate conversation into overdrive to say, well, he's kept them out because such and such? So I don't know how he's thinking about that. I sort of agree with you conceptually that it might be time for Joe Biden, who now is the presumptive nominee, to just act like the presumptive nominee, to act like we're in October, not in April. And I think he's getting that message. And I also think it sounds like from the conversations people have been having, including with Bernie Sanders and with Elizabeth Warren and with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, that the Joe Biden campaign is taking that part of the message seriously. Look, there are things about the Bernie Sanders campaign which were considered quite radical a few years ago that are now mainstream.
That's right.
$15 an hour, I remind people, is $30,000 a year. So everybody who thinks that the socialists are taking over and the poor are taking your money, it's $30,000 a year.
Exactly.
The minimum wage is 7.25. That's $15,000 a year. I saw a poll the other day that said 30% of people who identify as conservatives think that universal health care might be a good thing. And I've argued for a long time it actually shouldn't be a liberal or a conservative idea. It's actually a better idea that gets you a better return on your investment. So when you take all of that together, I think that there are things that we thought that now people are saying, you know what, if we had universal health care, we'd probably be in a better position today because there would be a whole bunch of people with underlying conditions who would seek treatment. And who might not die of coronavirus or might not go to work because they could afford to be at home and make somebody else sick. So you know, I think the world has changed a lot in the last couple of months.
I hope so. And one of the things my calling around the world, I hope, brings to light, I always ask the people in these other countries about their health care systems. And, you know, they're always, they know what it is over here. But when I mention the insurance card and it's tied to your employment, and then there's co-pays and deductibles, and the people who don't have insurance go bang, it is inconceivable to the rest of the civilized world. If we have one silver lining from this whole mess, hopefully it would keep the deaths down. They keep the curve flat. People, you know, the horror is minimized as much as it can be. But we come out on the other end with people knowing that, yeah, we need universal health care. We need a single payer health care system.
Yeah. And look, you think about how many of our major policies have come out of bad things. That's not a bad thing to wish for, right? The idea that good things come out of bad things. The Triangle Shirtwaist Factory meant that workers don't work in rooms that are locked, so that if there's a fire, they can't get out. People had to die for us to say, wow, that seems to be a no-brainer, and there are lots of places in the world who don't have basic rules like that.
That's right.
I think that, you know, I used to report on hurricanes, and I'd talk about climate change, and people would say, this isn't the time. And I've reported on so many mass shootings on site, and people have said, this isn't the time to talk about gun control. Well, guess what? It's actually always the time to talk about ways in which we can handle this thing that's happening now differently and better in the future. So I think we can hold both of those thoughts together. We're in a crisis, and rule number one is fix that. But let's talk about how we fix this moving forward.
Absolutely. Ali Velshi, I could keep talking to you for an hour. I know I've overstayed my welcome already. Thank you so much. What a pleasure this has been. I do enjoy waking up and watching you weekend mornings. And it's even better when someone's out and I see it's you in the fill-in chair, because I trust you and I like you. And now I think you're a friend. So Ali Velshi, find him. His website is at velshi.com. He's on Twitter at Ali Velshi. And of course, you find him on MSNBC pretty much all the time, but certainly Saturday and Sunday mornings from 8 to 10 Eastern. What a pleasure this has been. Thank you so much. It was great meeting you. There you go. It would help if I turned off the echo machine. And Ali Velshi, how awesome was that? Truly, I'm in awe. He turned out to be every bit as nice as I thought he would be. And also made me late for our next appointment. So let's not wait any longer, because she's there. She's on the line. You know Kelly Carlin. I'm looking for the our page. Yeah, I've got so many things. If you could see my desktop. There she is. Okay. Hey, Kelly Carlin.
Hello.
This is so exciting. So you're out there in Los Angeles. I'm here in Southern California. We've actually done this before, where I've participated with you in some of your workshops. But we'll get to that. Everybody knows the name Carlin. Of course, they know your dad. Kelly Carlin is the daughter of who I think is, if we had a comic laureate of the nation, I think George Carlin should be it. He is my hero. I mean, I grew up, you know, listening to Class Clown and reciting the seven dirty words. And the wisdom that your father imparted. And so when I got to know you, Kelly, I could see his influence in you so much. I was lucky enough to read your book when you came out with it a few years ago, A Carlin Home Companion, that everybody should read. And then the one woman show that you did that sort of grew out of the book, or the book grew out of the show, I'm not sure. But your life is fascinating, because you were born into show business and entertainment and humor, and you do that, and you've done that, and you continue to do that. But you also went off on your own and studied psychology. So explain to everybody, you have a master's in Jungian psychology?
Yeah, I got my master's in counseling psychology with an emphasis on Jungian psychology from a place called Pacifica Graduate Institute in Montecito, Santa Barbara, California. And so I've I got that 16 years ago in 2004. I've always been fascinated with people's journeys. Well, first of all, my own journey. That's why I wrote a memoir. And I've always been fascinated by, like, how do we go from what shaped us to who we are today, to who we want to be next, or what's emerging in us next. I've always been fascinated by that inner life. And both my parents were also fascinated with that. My dad obviously was a thinker and observer of the human condition. So he really taught me how to take that witnessing stance with the culture and people and in our own kind of inner life that he would share with some of his material. He wasn't very much a person who shared his personal life, but he shared this kind of universal inner life that we all had together. And then, of course, the big cultural questions. And then my mother was very much a seeker and also a wisdom teacher in her own right. She got sober in AA when I was about 12 years old. She was in her mid-30s at the time, and she became a leader in that organization and a person who sponsored women and helped women and had a women's group. And she was always out on some, you know, mesa somewhere studying with some teacher or something like that. So she was a real seeker. So I really got this training from my family of origin, that and the humor and the performing and all of that. And so, yeah, and I went and got my master's because I wanted to be a person who used my communication skills. You know, I have the urge to be out in front of people and sharing stuff. I although I am enjoying this being in my house thing also a lot lately, but we'll talk about that in a minute because that's kind of what I've been focusing on.
Right.
But I wanted to do more than just entertain people. I wanted always someone to walk away with something that they could carry with them that might like either plant the seed or break open the seed of transformation for them. I'm very committed to that transformational process. I'm fascinated by it. So that's why I dug into all that stuff academically and scholastically. Plus I've been a practicing Buddhist and studying Buddhism for over 20 years also. So yeah, you know, this kind of spiritual self-growth, psychological stuff is my personal bliss.
That's awesome. I just got to say, you know, in this time when all, whether you're watching a show like mine or something on MSNBC or CNN, we're looking into people's homes. And I got the last time I was in your home, Kelly, you have a different picture behind you. You have Billy Jack behind you. Oh my God. One Tin Soldier. That was the movie of my 12-year-old yep. year. And
me too, girl. Me too. We are like, we're right around the same age.
Yeah,
I think he was also kind of like my first crush a little bit. Like I had some sort of like weird sexual daddy feelings for him. But he was the man who fought injustice, right?
Right?
I mean, and it was so part of the times. And my friend Chris Bonno, B-O-N-N-O, he paints these amazing different kind of portraits and things. He'll paint whatever you want. And I saw a Billy Jack painting that he had done. I'm like, I need Billy Jack in my life.
Jack,
so
yes.
Billy Jack's Tom Laughlin's over my shoulder here. And he lives in this space. This is the space I work and coach and teach from. And he's always reminding me of that kind of inner ally, the one who's willing to stand up for wrong in the world and stand up for the underdog. I mean, that's really what he did, right? You
yes.
know? So yeah, he's an important
figure.
And the kids
at the school and yes. And oh my goodness, so many memories. My best friend, Eva, who's still my best friend to this day, she now lives in Boston. We were down here in Hollywood, Florida. We were in seventh grade. And Billy Jack was playing at the little Cine movie theater off of Sheridan Street. And we rode our bicycles and we went, and this was our movie and it still is. And not too long ago, I sent her an MP3 of Coven, who was the band who sang One Tin Soldier, and sent it to her. And she's like, oh, Billy Jack. So it's our thing. So when I saw that, I'm just like, oh my God, this is so perfect.
I love it. I absolutely love it. Oh, that's so great.
It is. We connect on so many levels. So
when
we're sitting here going through this, whatever it is, this thing that we're united across the planet in this isolation, we're all going through this stuff together. I don't know if I told you, I've been calling around the world and meeting people in other countries and checking in with them on how they're doing. I met a wonderful woman from Finland yesterday and one from Denmark and one from New South Wales, Australia. And it's just, it's bringing the world together. But I also know that we are all going through some mental things, many people who don't do a lot of work don't understand what's going on. People like me who fought depression for years, I feel that it's like, uh-oh, that's creeping in, and this is not good. And I watch how it's affecting my daughter, who will celebrate her 21st birthday locked in this house with us.
Uh-oh.
And so there have to be ways for us to get in our minds or get out of our minds and deal with it. And Kelly, honestly, you're the first person I thought of, because I know you lead these workshops from your home. You do it on Zoom. I did a series with you a couple of years ago that was just wonderful. And so I contacted you and said, hey, would you consider leading us in some kind of a guided meditation to that speaks to these weird times we're living in?
Yeah. Yeah. And before we get to that, I just want to talk about a couple of things, one of which is whether you are used to being in relationship with your inner life or not, you are today. Mm-hmm. It's right here, front and center. So whatever our stuff is that normally maybe we're too busy to deal with, or we cover over, or we distract ourselves with, and we all do that on normal levels all the time, you know. But for those of us who aren't used to hearing all of these lovely voices that live inside of our head, here they are, you know, front and center. And so, and it can be, and those of us who are used to even listening to these things, there's even more voices, and they're even, you know, because we have nothing really to distract ourselves unless we distract ourselves knowingly, which is also really important during these times to do some healthy distractions. I've been doing jigsaw puzzles.
Oh.
My husband and I are on jigsaw puzzle number 8.
Wow.
That's all I have to say.
Okay.
But I love it. So that it's okay. It's just okay that whatever's coming up is here. And that's one of the things I think that's hardest for us humans to deal with is we want to push away the stuff that's kind of scary or negative or different or new. And we spend so much effort and energy pushing things away or trying to make things that are here change that we can't change. Like, we're in this. Like, we can't change that there's a virus all over the world. We can't change that most of us are asked to stay in our homes right now and not work. Or, you know, we can't change that the economy is doing this thing that it's doing, you know, so we're feeling very powerless right now. And so we fight against that powerlessness. And the thing I've learned is that the fighting against it usually causes more suffering than just learning to be with what is right now.
Okay.
So, and that's kind of the basics of what Buddhism is. Like, you know, suffering comes from the fact that we are pushing against two big realities, which is that everything changes.
Hello.
And that what is like, we can't change the change. So everything's changing and we can't do anything about it. We're powerless over most of it. And so the first thing to do is to just let ourselves and gives ourselves permission to just be with whatever we're going through. Whether it's severe anxiety, which I've had an anxiety disorder in my past. I had panic attacks for a good 12 years of my life in my 20s and into my 30s. Mm. I understand what that feels like. I had a panic attack about 2 weeks ago. It came back up. So whether we're dealing with anxiety, which we normally deal with, and it's at an elevated level, or we're noticing anxiety for the first time, like, why can't I sleep? Why aren't I sleeping well? Why am I eating everything in my refrigerator? Yes, me too. Why can't I stop jigsaw puzzling, or why can't I turn off the news even? One way we deal with anxiety is we want information. We think more information is going to make things us feel safer. And it is true that having a certain amount of information can calm us. But when we reach the saturation point with information, and the bottom line is every day you don't need as much information as you think you need in order to get through this.
That's true.
So turning off the news or turning away from media can feel scary at first, because it's kind of like a lifeline or a security blanket for us to have a voice in the house or to have Ali Velshi mm-hmm. or yourself or someone always there, right?
Right.
But our nervous system gets overstimulated and it can't ramp down and restore itself. So we're in this sympathetic fight or flight all the time with it.
That makes sense. So
learning to be with just where we are right now and what we're feeling and letting it be okay is the first step. And it can feel like an impossibility. Like, what do you mean? I can't just be with this anxiety or this depression or this uncertainty. And yet I'm here to say that you actually can. You can do this. So I can absolutely lead us in a little like 5 to 7 minute exercise.
Where
we're just going to sit with what is right now in our day. So I'm going to invite everyone out there who's listening or watching to, if you feel safe enough, to close your eyes. And the first thing I want you to do with your eyes closed, and I'm going to close my eyes too, is I just want you to just recognize what it feels like to just be in the space that you're in right now, whatever room you're in. And one way we can do that is we can just open our ears and focus our awareness on what we're hearing right now. And of course, you're hearing my voice in this space. But when I'm not talking, what are you noticing? Maybe you notice airplane noise or car noise, although these days there's less of that. Maybe the air conditioning is on. Maybe you notice some other people in your house making noise. Whatever it is, just notice the noises. And let your whole awareness be that. And then we're going to move now to noticing our bodies. Just letting our bodies be in this space. And the first way we can do that is to notice the weight of our body on this chair or sofa or wherever you happen to be right now. And if you're standing, noticing your weight on your feet. And notice all the places that your body is touching this chair or the ground. And that's all you have to notice right now. And then now what I want you to notice is just, I want you to notice your body. And what does it feel like? Does it feel, are you noticing some tension? Maybe some butterflies? Are you noticing that you can't really feel your body? Maybe you feel really spaced out, disembodied. Maybe you're feeling super heavy. Maybe you're feeling anxiety in your chest. Just notice it like you were a scientist and you were going to have to describe it to someone else. So don't get attached to maybe the emotion behind it. But what's the sensation? And just say to yourself some adjectives that might describe. Floaty. Maybe fluttery chest. And just by noticing this, you might even notice now that something has changed, that something else is showing up. Maybe it is an emotion. Maybe it's tiredness. Maybe it's a craving. Suddenly, double chocolate Milanos sound really good. whatever it is, I just want you to give yourself permission to just be with what's here now. Knowing that you're perfectly safe. There are no tigers in the room. So you're okay here. Just feel whatever's going on. And just notice it. You don't have to do anything about it. You don't have to change it. You don't have to solve it. And whatever you're feeling is allowed. You have full permission to be feeling whatever it is you're feeling, just in the here and the now. There's no right way to do this. There's no wrong way to do this. You could even be feeling total confusion about these instructions. And you could just acknowledge, I'm feeling confused. That's what's here right now. And notice that when you sit with what is, what's true for you in this moment, just watch and see what happens next. Maybe the same feeling stays. Maybe it changes into something else. Maybe confusion now is relaxed or tired is awake, just like before. Just name the sensation or the experience you're having. And notice the permission and the space that you're allowed to give yourself to just be here. Just notice it. Are you comfortable being here, giving yourself permission to do this? Or is it challenging? Nothing's wrong, nothing's right. There's no right way or wrong way. It's just your experience. And then the last thing I want us to do is just take a moment and focus on our breath. And what does that mean? That just means now taking your awareness and noticing your natural breathing. And you can do this by watching or feeling your tummy or your chest or the air moving through your mouth or your nose. You can put your hand on your chest even. And feel your body ever so slightly moving. And know that your breath is your one companion as long as you are conscious and alive, that is always with you. It's always here for you. It's your ally. It's your companion. And it's the very thing that knows you and is always with you. And it is the one way in which you have proof that the universe is supporting you right now. Because you're in a room that has air in it for you to breathe. And so with that, gently, we're going to come out of this meditation. Slowly open your eyes if they've been closed. And just notice where you are now. There's no right, there's no wrong. You may be exactly where you were 6 minutes ago when we started this, or you may be somewhere else. The point is that there's actually nowhere to go and nothing to do. There's just where you are right now.
And it's okay to be quiet like that and have your thoughts, but take deep breaths. And you know, the whole issue about quieting one's mind, if you concentrate on the breath, that's where your mind is spending its energy, right?
And here's the thing, too, is everyone says, I can't meditate because I can't shut my mind up.
Right.
Well, guess what? Your mind's job is not to shut up. Your brain and your mind are hardwired in order to always be in some sort of mode to protect you. And it's always looking for three things. It's looking for the horizon to figure out, am I safe? Are there tigers in the room? Is there food? Is there resources to keep this body alive? And if you're of mating age, where's the thing that I need to mate in order to keep the species alive? Like, that's the hard wiring of your brain. So your brain is activated to be doing that all the time. That's kind of the more primitive part of our brain. And it's always moving. So the first time we sit with silence or stop or be quiet and into stillness, this thing comes roaring forward because it's the first time we're actually noticing it. Like, oh, look at this companion that's here all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so the way I like to do is just meet it as if you were meeting a friendly neighbor and go, oh, hi. Hi, mind. Hi, brain. Thank you for being here. Thank you for doing your job and keeping me safe right now. But I want to let you know, there are no tigers in the room. There is food in the fridge. And right now, I don't need to find someone to mate with.
Thank God.
You may want to go in the other room and do that with your partner. That's certainly an option.
Right.
But when we're sitting down to meditate, these are the three things. So we get really friendly with it and say, I'm going to let you be here and know that you're probably going to distract me every 10 to 15 to 20 seconds. But my whole job is just to move back around to the breath and say, all right, we're just going to go back to the breath for a little while. Mm-hmm. I know you'll be back to distract me. It's no big deal. It's perfectly normal. And I'm just going to sit here. And there's so many great apps right now. You know, there's Insight Timer and there's Calm. Yep. Yep. And there's all these great apps that I really, really recommend to people to connect to. There's guided meditations. There's timers. There's all sorts of things. But what I'm excited about this time is that people are getting to see that maybe they do need to be friendlier with their inner life and their mind right now. And so if you've never done meditation, yay, welcome to the world of mindfulness and meditation. It's a beautiful time to learn about it because there's so many resources. And if you're someone like me who's been doing this a while, has a bit of a practice, has been on this journey for a while, yay, you get to really deepen your sense of retreat and your sense of practice and really make this time your own and start to strengthen that muscle even more. So that as we move through these uncertain times, which I'm guessing is going to be seriously another year for sure.
Yeah.
And there's nothing, we're not going back to the way life was in January. So welcome to the new normal.
Yeah.
And I hate that. I hate that phrase, but it's true. So who do you want to be in this new normal? How do you want to learn to be with yourself? And how do you want to resource yourself more during this new normal time?
So people can do this on themselves. You mentioned Calm and Insight Timer. I've got both of them on my phone. But you also lead some groups. And in fact, you're doing a couple of things. You have a weekly Unplug with Kelly Carlin. Right?
Yeah, I'm not doing that live anymore.
Okay.
But people
can
certainly sign up for it. If you find me on my email, my mailing list, which is, if you go to kellycarlin.com, you can sign up for my mailing list.
Okay. Everyone
and I'm
should.
Always putting an offer out. And right now there's an archive of those things.
Nice.
And they're 90-minute lessons around mindfulness and all sorts of self-help stuff. I'm not doing that live anymore. But what I am doing right now is I'm working with women. I have a program called Women on the Verge.
Yes.
And it's about going deep to take the leap. And I really believe that women are the future in a lot of ways, because women have a lot of resources within them and have a lot of ways of looking at the world that I think is what the world really needs right now. So I'm very interested in helping women who want to share their gifts with the world to step into their power and their authority and their own voice, and to have a deeper relationship with their inner life, move the baggage, the old stories, the old narratives out, so that they can step into their strength and their power and their vision and move out into the world. So I've been doing this work now for about a year and a half. I also work, part of this work is about helping women who are in a major transition in their life, whether it's divorce or they're widowed or they're moving into a new career or they're empty nesting, or they're just in that space where they know it's time for them to step up and into fully their fully realized version of themselves. And so you can go to womenontheverge.com.
Okay.
And that's a landing page, and it talks a little bit about the program. And there's a little survey there that you can answer some questions to really see if it's the right fit for you. And if it is, I love to have conversations, and I give a free coaching call to women that it feels like it's the right fit for. And then you can always find me on Twitter. I'm always doing stuff on Twitter. Sometimes I'm doing live stuff there. I do live stuff on Instagram. I'm no longer on Facebook. I walked away in November. I'm very happy. Could not do it anymore. Yes, I know Instagram is owned by Facebook. I used to do live stuff over there, but I usually do live stuff on Instagram or Twitter. I'm very dedicated to helping people look through these lenses. And right now, my main focus is with women, and really hoping that women can find their sovereignty in the world. Like, I know that's a weird word to use, but I think when women hear it, they hear me, which is their rightful place, you know, in their lives, and therefore letting the work that they're here to do in the world move through them so that they can have the impact that they want to have in the world. Because we all want to have some sort of positive impact.
Oh, yeah. And this is, they keep telling us it's the year of the woman. Let's make it so.
I think it's the millennium of the woman.
That works.
Fingers crossed.
That works.
Not men. And I'm not a man guy. I'm not a man basher.
Right.
Nothing like that, people.
No.
I love men. Men are important in my life. But there's something about being with a group of women and growing with a group of women and going through a transformational process with a group of women that's very different than being in a co-ed situation. And that's why I work exclusively with women.
Gotcha. All right. Well, the website again is kellycarlin.com. You'll find all this there. Also, womenontheverge.com. I'll put it all on my blog at NicoleSandler.com along with this show. Kelly, thank you so much. What a treat this was. What a great way to end the week. And because this is something that people can go back to and give you just a taste. This was a taste of a meditation.
Little drop.
Exactly. And expand on it. And it does help. Someone in the chat room just said, well, I was feeling really stressed. That helped. And that's what it's about. It's about helping. You've helped me so much, Kelly. I adore you. I thank you so much for doing this with us today.
I'm really, really honored to have the invitation, and thank you for having me.
It's my pleasure. You take care out there. Stay safe.
And I will. We'll see. And Billy Jack says hi.
And Billy Jack. We'll have to do a virtual maybe watching of the movie one of these days.
Oh, my God. Yes, totally. Left.
One tin soldier rides away. Okay. Da-dun, 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 da-dun. Bye.
Bye.
I'll see you later. Bye. All right, everyone. With that, we have run way too long. So I am going to, I'm going to have to edit this for Progressive Voices, but everyone else will get the full show on the podcast and the YouTube. That all will stay. But let me run so I can edit it to get something on the air at 5 o'clock at Progressive Voices. Thank you for being here today. I thought this was a special show. I thought it was a pretty special week. We'll get through this. As I said earlier, it may take a different shape or form, but let's do it together. All right. Have a wonderful, wonderful weekend. Thank you so much for listening. And I know I keep threatening to do a Monday show, Monday or Tuesday. Stop by Monday. We'll see. I don't know. I can't promise anything. Thanks, everyone. Bye-bye.